So it's a pleasure to be here today. Some of you I know and others I don't, but I'm Patty Gans, and I've been around UCLA a long time. As I was just telling Dr. Brook, he was my attending when I was an intern or a resident in the medicine clinic.
He was only 12.
Yes. And Ron Hayes and I, we started something called URIC, which was the UCLA RAND Interdisciplinary Quality of Life Group somewhere in the early 1990s, and so I think the CER group is kind of another form first of getting people together. So I was very happy to come here and help and talk about what I've been doing, and it also gave me a chance to put together a talk. So this is a completely new talk, which I had a chance to kind of review all the stuff I'd done in a long time. And so I'm going to show you serial research studies that we did, which were largely observational and or cross-sectional, which I'm going to show when I can other data from randomized studies that show results that are quite similar. So that's kind of the message of today. And it's really focused on patient-reported outcomes. And I'll give you a little background about breast cancer and some of this, so those of you who may not be familiar with the disease will have some understanding. So more than 1 in 3 Americans will be diagnosed with cancer in their lifetime, and in fact, it is the leading cause of death for those under age 80. It's surpassed heart disease. So it's a big issue, and with the aging of the population, we are just going to have an epidemic of cancer, and that's mostly because of screening and early detection, or overdiagnosis, whatever you want to call it, for both breast, colon, and prostate cancer, which can be diagnosed very early and has a very good prognosis. So we're going to be seeing a lot more people with a cancer diagnosis who will be survivors. And I have really conceptualized breast cancer as a model for the study of adult cancer survivors because it really spans the whole age range. You have people, unfortunately, as young as in their 20s, women who get breast cancer. It doesn't affect men except rarely. But we have very complex treatments that have evolved over many, many years with randomized clinical trials, lots of development of drugs, and understanding really of the biology. And because this often affects women in the prime of life, it can have a very significant impact on their health and well-being as well as their vocational life. And really only about 5 to 10% of individuals have hereditary predisposition genes. So the vast majority of women are developing cancer just because they've lived long enough, just because they're women, just because their ovarian hormones expose their breast tissue to repetitive cyclic hormonal exposure and the development of cancer. So, what happened to me? Well, when I was a medical student at UCLA, I was rotating through Harvard General Hospital in 1971. And I didn't know what I was going to be. I was going to be a cardiologist, actually, at that point in time. But it was my first medical rotation on my junior year. And the surgeons at my hospital there were participating in the NSABP B04 trial, which was a randomized trial looking at radical mastectomy, which was the standard of time with removal of the pectoral muscles, removal of extensive axillary nodes, versus modified radical mastectomy, which also removed the nodes but not the chest wall muscles, or just a simple or total mastectomy without the axillary dissection. But what happened to women at that time was they didn't even know they had cancer before they underwent general anesthesia and had a biopsy. And under general anesthesia, they had a frozen section biopsy, which you hope was accurate. And then they woke up, if they were participating in this trial, not knowing if they were going to have been assigned to a radical mastectomy, a modified radical, or a simple mastectomy. So they were amazingly courageous. But that was how breast cancer treatment was in those days. And fortunately, the B04 trial showed, which I'm going to show you in the next slides here, with 25 years of follow-up, that there was actually no difference between actually the simple mastectomy and the radical mastectomy. And obviously the modified radical mastectomy became the standard of care. But what you see is whether we remove the nodes or not, these are the women with negative nodes, these are the women with positive nodes, poorer survival, and again, overall survival, unfortunately declining. So we have to do something more than surgery. That's how we get to many, many years of adjuvant therapy. Giving you this background so you can understand when we start to look at breast cancer outcomes. So again, in terms of looking at breast cancer, there was this beginning of understanding that this was a systemic disease, that removing the breast, no matter how radical or limited, didn't lead to an improvement in mortality. Women still died of distant disease, and we began to have some early adjuvant trials that began to look at chemotherapy, mostly with women with a lot of positive nodes or very big tumors. In the 1980s, there was increasing in consumer involvement in care, which meant that there were women like Rose Kushner, who was a woman in the publishing industry, who was very upset that women had to go to sleep and not know if they had cancer or not, couldn't participate in decisions. And so there was mounting evidence that you could, in fact, do an outpatient biopsy and then make a decision later. Didn't hamper the outcomes from the cancer. And we had studies that began to show that doing a mastectomy was equivalent to just removing the lump and giving radiation. And again, increasing patient involvement in the decision making. Again, happening in all aspects of medicine, but clearly here in breast cancer. And what you see here, kind of marching through these slides, this is 1985. These were the number of women who had never had a mammogram. And if you look here at 2000, very few of them had never had a mammogram, in increasing numbers. So earlier diagnosis, smaller tumors. And here, chemotherapy beginning to be used in the 70s and 80s. Tamoxifen being used here, green, and then both together. And again, these interventions, these therapies that were disseminated after randomized trials within the broader community of patients with cancer led to improved survival for this disease. And again, just if you see here, you see this decline in mortality. This is after 1990. Again, due to earlier diagnosis, better use of adjuvant therapy. So this is really one of the triumphs of oncology. And as you can see, this has happened in my own career. So what happens in the 21st century? Well, now we diagnose these tumors very early, but women actually often have to go through much more complex treatments. They don't lose their breast, but they have radiation, they have chemotherapy, and often they may be treated with 10 years of endocrine therapy. So they're taking something for a very long period of time. We have trastuzumab or Herceptin, which was discovered and was very effective against a very aggressive form of breast cancer. Those women are now largely cured with adjuvant therapy, and we're able to tailor the therapy based on the biology of the cancer. So a lot more individualization and personalization is going on in cancer therapy today, which is really good. And the gene carriers are often undergoing prophylactic or preventive surgeries to prevent the development of cancer. And this is just what it looks like. And again, just to kind of show you, this is a very long natural history process from atypical hyperplasia to ductal carcinoma to invasive cancer. We're talking about a 20 to 30 year period of time, which if we had behavioral or drug modification, we might even be able to prevent the disease from happening. And this is, again, showing you how gene expression profiles have been used to actually subclassify breast cancer. We're having much more targeted therapies against specific subtypes. So in the future, we hope that therapy will be more tailored. And what does that mean? That we're not going to give cytotoxic chemotherapy to everyone. We're going to give it only to people who may benefit. The kind of therapy that we're going to give is going to be based on the kind of treatment. And again, we hope that we'll be able to prevent or reduce the incidence of breast cancer among women because, again, this is a very common disease. But for now, there are still many challenges. Breast cancer treatment is very complex. It's multimodal, multidisciplinary, very uncoordinated sometimes, very toxic, expensive. And really, women do pay a high upfront cost for survival. So I've again told you that survival has improved, cancer is diagnosed earlier, but women still have to go through a lot of this stuff. And for many individuals, cancer is now a chronic disease. And when I say chronic, it may be chronic in the sense that there may be scars and sequelae from the treatment that we've given. But even if the treatment is very, very minimal, those women have to worry about getting a second cancer or a recurrence of cancer. So it's in their minds, even if they have a very limited experience. So some of the research questions that we have explored over time really has been to look at the impact of breast cancer and its treatment on quality of life. And I'm going to be showing you that data about whether breast-conserving treatment is better, what happens to sexual functioning as a result of these treatments, how we manage menopausal symptoms, what we can do to decrease some of the physical and emotional effects, And more recently, my research has focused on some of the biological mechanisms underpinning these late effects. So this is the data from the NSABP B06 trial, which was, again, a very landmark study that looked at whether you could randomly assign women to either have a mastectomy or a lumpectomy with radiation or a lumpectomy alone. This was a very hard trial to recruit to. This was in the late 1970s. This paper's from 1985. The surgeons actually had a lot of trouble discussing the randomization, and they actually went to a pre-randomized design where the surgeon just presented to the patient, you know, we have a trial and you've been assigned a lumpectomy, because again, very difficult to describe. But nevertheless, this was successfully completed, and you can see, in again, the late 1970s. But no quality of life study was included, because Bernie Fisher, who's really one of my heroes in the case of breast cancer treatment, said, it's obvious, if you don't lose your breast, you're so much better off. So we shouldn't do this. Ivan Borofsky, who some of you may know, who was an early pioneer in quality of life assessment, actually went to the University of Pittsburgh and tried to incorporate some quality of life measures into this study, and it didn't work. So we were left with a randomized trial that actually showed equivalence among all of these three approaches. So this is comparing total mastectomy, the squares, to the diamonds, the segmental mastectomy. No difference in disease-free survival, no difference in distant disease-free survival, and a little tad favoring, actually, the segmental mastectomy group, who actually got radiation. Some of these women actually got chemotherapy, a very small number, but really no difference. So what does this mean to patients? And we went through a long period of time where these treatments were absolutely equivalent, and patients would be told, well, you can lose your breast or not. It's up to you. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible time. So we began to do some research looking at this, and I actually had a randomized controlled intervention study that we were doing that we prospectively followed. It was over 200 women, but this was the first report where we looked at an observational cohort of women here in LA, looking at whether their quality of life was any different between mastectomy and segmental mastectomy. I apologize, the reproduction is poor, but there's no difference in, this is again a cancer-specific quality of life instrument called the FLIC, Functional Living Index Cancer, no difference in expert-related Karnofsky performance status. These are self-reported measures. This is total mood disturbance, and this is the segmental mastectomy group, and actually 1 month after surgery, the segmental mastectomy group was actually worse off. They were in the midst of getting their radiation. And you can see there's really not much difference between the mastectomy and the breast-conserving treatment. And if we look here, these are two particular scales. This is clothing and body image. Out of 35 or 36 scales from the cancer-specific measure, the CARES, the only two scales that showed any difference were body image and clothing. So these women, you could have your breast gone, or you could have breast-conserving surgery. No difference in physical, psychosocial functioning, no difference in sexual functioning. Only difference was it was harder to find clothes to fit and didn't feel as good about your body. Kind of obvious, but, you know, again, contrary to what had been hypothesized by the physicians. Now, here's a randomized controlled trial that was done at about the same time where quality of life was included. This was done at the National Cancer Institute, and they had 142 women. And again, the points from this were that there was no difference in psychosocial function by surgery type. So this, again, confirmed what we had seen. A significant difference in body image. Okay, the women who had lost their breast felt more uncomfortable with their body in the nude, but no difference in sexual relationships. And so again, thinking that just because you preserve your breast, your sexual life is going to be better is a fallacy. Yes.
Just wondering how one would measure the difference in sexual relationships. I mean, you might have a situation where the average person's experience wasn't different, but a subset. Mm-hmm. For a subset, it would be different. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, are you measuring means, or are you
these were
looking
means,
at distribution?
But we actually had a whole RR1, which I'll show you some of the data from later. And there are subgroups who it is worse in, and those are women who get chemotherapy, as an example. I'll show you some other data. And younger women. But so if you became menopausal. So we, based on some of the data, preliminary data, this is why it's 30 years worth of work, you're going to see a series of data that one question leads to another. So again, the point here is, though, the simplistic notion that if you preserve the breast, everything's going to be hunky-dory, you're not going to be distressed, you're not going to have any physical complaints, was incorrect. And so I think clinicians didn't appreciate this, and I think that's why it was important to discuss this with women in terms of these outcomes. So because I had that initial cohort of women who we followed during the first year, and we had this inkling that sexual functioning and didn't improve over the course of the year, whereas some physical and psychological things got better, we said, wouldn't it be interesting to follow these women out further? So we got some additional funding from the California Cancer Society, and we split the cohort of about 200 women into two subgroups, one that we picked up at 2 years and another that we picked up at 3 years. And again, what you see is the POMS, which was that distress measure where they're highly distressed at 1 month, are coming down by 3 years. And again, this is not by type of surgery, this is the whole cohort. And then the quality of life scores out here at 1 year at about 127, and you can see they don't get much better. So people tend to recover by a year in terms of the global quality of life measures and don't seem to get better. Now, this is where I first used the SF-36 in my research, and this was again in the late 80s, early 90s. And we decided, I said, well, these women are really kind of becoming normal, they're survivors. Let's see how they look compared to the MOS norms, which are over here. And overall, if you look at them at 2 or 3 years out, and physical functioning, role functioning, energy and fatigue, emotional well-being, they're doing just as well as the MOS norms, and social functioning is quite high. And again, health perceptions are actually better than this group. So if nothing else, they're not worse off. Now, you can say, maybe this is a different socioeconomic stratum. You know, maybe they're better off than the MOS norms for that reason. But at least they're not worse than the general population. And I've got the maven here in the back who is going to say something, too. Yes, sir?
Is there a sort of phenomenon where sort of post-cancer diagnosis for survivors, there's a sort of
I'll show you some data where that may be the case in terms of having accomplished something.
Right, and having survived.
Yes, but it's in the women who get chemotherapy, not in the other groups. Okay, paradoxically. And I just wanted to show you on the cancer-specific measure, the CARES, where we were tracking sexual functioning, because remember, I was concerned that that wasn't getting better. Everything else seemed to be getting better. We see that at 2 and 3 years, sexual functioning is actually worse than it was here in the first year, and the marital interaction was actually worse. So this led to an R01, where we focused on sexuality and intimacy after breast cancer. We did an intervention study and two large cross-sectional studies. And this first paper really reported on the first cross-section of women. It was about 858 women. And we conducted this study in LA and Washington, D.C. We were actually very interested in also looking at African-American women to see what their experience was with the breast cancer, as well as the sexuality and intimacy. And again, I only put the data up here for the demographics to show that they're pretty well-educated. College grads and postgraduates are about 50% of the sample, so it's a high SES. And this paper was somewhat groundbreaking in that we broke our sample into age groups less than 50, 50 to 59, and over 60, and we were actually one of the first to begin to show that younger women with breast cancer through these studies were having a harder time. And again, not to belabor the point, but we did the SF-36 data on the whole sample. And to make a long story short, physical functioning and quality of life and symptoms varied by age. There was more in the way of depressive symptoms in the younger women, more emotional distress in the younger women, greater physical problems in the older women. Again, many of these things you would predict based on what happens in general with the SF-36 norms. We had also a very detailed symptom checklist. It was one that I had developed for the NSABP breast cancer prevention trial. So I've been able to use that same symptom checklist in my breast cancer samples, and I have the normative data from high-risk women from that randomized trial. So that's been very powerful. And again, this is just to show you the SF-36 scales where overall, this is the breast cancer sample. They're above, in general, the MOS norms. So again, the message here was, you know, breast cancer survivors are not doing so badly, although they do have a lot of symptoms, and I'm going to go into that in more detail. So that was kind of the first cross-sectional cohort. We then did a second cohort of women that we recruited. This is over 1,100 women. And in this cross-sectional analysis, we, again, this is how the women broke down, not randomized, but you can see the treatments that they received were distributed like this. And we asked the question in this study that was focused on sexuality and intimacy, is there a differential impact based on the type of treatment that the patients had in terms of adjuvant therapy? And what you see here is these are the women who had no other therapy other than surgery or surgery and radiation, and about 40% of them are reporting hot flashes and night sweats, and this is actually quite comparable to the same data I got in the NSABP high-risk healthy women. So that's probably the norm for this age group of women. But you can see if they were put on tamoxifen, their hot flash rate went up to 60%. These are women on chemo alone, and these are on women with chemo and tamoxifen, and this is a highly significant difference. Same thing for night sweats. So again, any adjuvant therapy adds to your vasomotor symptoms. This is vaginal discharge, which is in fact a side effect of the tamoxifen, which is significantly worse. And vaginal dryness, so this is getting to Martin's question about other subgroups. So women who get adjuvant therapy are more likely to have vaginal dryness, most associated with the chemotherapy, more likely to have pain with intercourse. This is self-reported weight gain, and we didn't see any difference in the women here. And this is those same scales related to sexual functioning. This is body image. Again, this is all controlled for the type of surgery they had, no difference. And then, again, higher scores worse, with sexual functioning significantly worse for the women who had any kind of adjuvant therapy. So again, if you can imagine, you have a patient visiting you, she's got early stage breast cancer, maybe she has DCIS or, you know, some early, you know, microscopic invasive cancer, and you're trying to decide what to do, this is useful information about these kinds of therapies. This is looking at the SF-36 scales, and again, these women are all 1 to 5 years out after diagnosis. They could be on their adjuvant endocrine therapy, but they finished their chemotherapy. And in this particular evaluation, looking by type of treatment, you can see that here there's some difference in physical functioning only in terms of the adjuvant therapy, but not much. Again, here's emotional functioning, not much difference. And again, energy and fatigue and general health perceptions. These are women about 2 to 3 years out after their cancer treatment. So the SF-36 is probably not the best measure to look at these things, although it does give us some anchorage, if you will, to the general population. And here are the component summary scales, and you can see they're just hovering around 50 with no difference. And these, again, are adjusted for age and other factors. So the early conclusions, and I actually did speak at a lot of meetings, you know, breast cancer, it's not as bad as you think. You know, women are actually doing pretty well, they're recovering, they're doing okay. But we did see some subgroups in whom there were more difficulties, such as the women in particular who got chemotherapy, the vasomotor and vaginal symptoms in particular. And again, overall, they seem to be doing very well. Well, then I was able to get some additional funding, and we actually took this cohort of about 2,000 women, and we were able to track about 800 of them later. I'm looking at Barbara, who did all the work here. And we now surveyed them about 5 years later, and we wanted to see what had changed over time. And in this particular analysis here, again, of the SF-36, well, that hint that there might have been some separation in terms of physical functioning for women who got adjuvant therapy actually plays out as we look at these women in the long term, with physical functioning being poor in the adjuvant therapy groups compared to the non-treated, also role functioning physical, social functioning, pain, and general health perceptions. So again, an observational cohort longitudinal study, but a suggestion of the burden over time in some of these aspects. And if you look at the physical component summary score, you can see there's about a third of a standard deviation. And when I was interviewed by the press about this, you know, what does it mean? You know, probably if somebody had a very competitive tennis game or some other, you know, physical endeavor that they were involved in, they would probably be noticing some decrement in it. But I would say for the average patient, we don't see huge differences. other findings, chemotherapy continued to be a big problem in terms of sexual dysfunction. About one third of the survivors actually reported persistent fatigue. We've used the SF-36 vitality scale actually to classify patients, and women less than 50 are significantly different on a lot of biochemical measures of inflammation compared to women who are energetic. And we've shown persistent fatigue in a subgroup of women persisting from the earlier assessments out to 5 to 10 years, usually associated with more intensive therapies, more chemotherapy, radiation, and so forth. So it appears that there may be a late toxicity associated with that. Now, I just stuck in this other little study because we wanted to look and see if reconstruction had anything to do with those sexual body image changes, which we knew mastectomy led to. And this was a cross-sectional study looking at the two cohorts of women. And you can see about 57% had had lumpectomy, and about 17% had had mastectomy with reconstruction. Mind you, the reconstruction in these days was often done at a separate surgery. It was before we have tram flaps and so forth, but still women were left at least with a reconstructed breast. And again, I just plotted these data out the other day. There's actually no difference. All P's were insignificantly different across the SF-36, so this is not, again, a sensitive measure in terms of picking up the differences. But when we looked at things like depressive symptoms or social support, no difference by whether you were reconstructed or not. No difference in terms of fear of recurrence. Again, you wouldn't expect that. No significant differences in the partner relationship, didn't make it better or worse. But there was a significant impact on body image, feeling comfortable with the body, attractiveness. And again, for a lot of women, the overall conclusion that cancer had a negative impact on their sex life. Okay. So, with that kind of background information about these intermediate and longer term effects, and the large number of survivors who were accumulating in the population, we said, what can we do to actually improve this transition into this recovery period? And so we actually did a randomized controlled psychosocial intervention trial for women at the end of treatment when we realized we'd taken women who were actually pretty healthy and made them kind of sick in terms of the physical symptoms that they were experiencing. And this was conducted not just in Washington, D.C. and L.A., but we actually had a site in Kansas because we wanted to make sure that we weren't just looking at coastal phenomena. And so what I'm going to show you is actually some of the descriptive data from the sample. I'm not going to show you the outcomes of the trial, but this three-armed randomized trial actually did a video intervention, had a control group that had just the NCI's Facing Forward book, which was quite primitive at that time, the book with a video, and then an in-person counseling intervention trying to help women at the end of treatment move forward. And so the things that we were interested in exploring in this particular study were kind of this transition to survivorship. We do a lot today to prepare patients when they're actually going to start treatment. We, again, have evolved an elaborate way of telling them about all the toxicities of therapy, making those decisions, they're involved in shared decision-making with the treatment. But when women finish their treatment, nobody kind of helps them to go forward. And so the focus of this study was actually to look at that. But I'm going to focus more today on the descriptive information about what we found. But first I want to show you what women say in their own words. And this was part of the video that we used.
After cancer, it takes time for the body to recover fully, especially strength and energy. Paulette Sadler was diagnosed in 1988. Her treatment, including a lumpectomy and chemotherapy, had physical consequences she had not expected.
Well, when the treatment was over, I can honestly say I was a wreck because I had a lot of complications. So when I was finished, I was really physically exhausted. And I think probably like most women who are going through this, you're trying to keep the rest of your life going at the same time. So you may have a husband or relationship, children. You try at least superficially keep those things going, but it takes a lot out of you. people think, oh, your treatment's over, let's just get back in that car, do that 60-hour work week, bake those cookies, do that laundry, vacuum that rug, and that's not happening. I mean, it's really not, and I think a lot of women probably do themselves more harm than good by setting that up as an expectation that they can't possibly live up to.
Like most women recovering from breast cancer, Paulette learned it helps to have a realistic set of expectations about the post-treatment period. Dr. Susan Love, a breast surgeon who's cared for thousands of recovering women, agrees.
I think that one of the expectations that women have, and it's the doctor's fault in part because we give them this expectation, is that as soon as the treatment's over, they're going to feel perfectly normal. And it just isn't true. It takes a long time to get back to normal. One of my patients told me it takes as long to get back to normal as it did to get the treatment. So that means 6 months, sometimes even a year, to start feeling totally like yourself again. One thing that's really important is if you're tired, rest. Take a nap. You know, don't try to be superwoman.
I think it's very important for women to learn that it's okay to ask for help. You can't do the level of activities that you did before. I was very fortunate at that time. I had someone coming into my house to help me take care of my daughter, and she did the laundry and a lot of the really heavy housework. But I had neighbors who would shop for me. My mother-in-law shopped. My husband pitched in whenever he could. So I think it's really important to mobilize your troops. And I think you should look at it that way and not look at it as a sign of weakness.
Paulette's decision to acknowledge her physical limitations and get the help she needed is an example of one type of approach-oriented coping, dealing with her problem by taking direct action. Bea Kent, a widowed 72-year-old cancer survivor, grappled with her own challenges after treatment. Her treatment included a lumpectomy, radiation therapy, and tamoxifen. She suffered from lymphedema, or swelling of the arm, a common post-treatment condition.
Yes, I noticed that my left arm, because it was my left side that was affected, was becoming swollen. I got on the internet, and I really wanted to find out more about this, because this was something that we had not discussed when I originally had my diagnosis. And I found that there were two doctors in Australia who had written a 100-page book and put it on the internet. And I accessed it and printed it out. And so I felt that I was taking part in my own treatment.
Being an active participant can be important during treatment and can be even more important once treatment is over. At the age of 37, Lori Plager underwent a lumpectomy, chemotherapy, and radiation. Now moving into her post-treatment phase, she's taking tamoxifen.
What's different about me physically is I have a scar on my breast, on my right breast, and it's pretty faint. And I have three little tiny dots, which are tattoos from the radiation. And my hair is completely different. Initially, when somebody says to you, gee, you're going to take medication where you're going to lose all of your hair, every hair on your body, and we may have to cut off your breast, and the chemotherapy is going to cause you to be infertile, most likely, you think, what do I have left? Your femininity is really tied to your breasts and your reproductive organs and your hair. I mean, those are really what marks somebody as a female.
Lori's treatment affected more than just the outward signs of her femininity. It also caused her period to stop for several months, threatening her ability to have children.
Family is very important to me. I mean, I've always wanted to have my own family. That's probably because I have a warm, loving family. My sister has two children, two boys. That's part of, you know, the dream that you put together for yourself when you're a little girl.
Fertility is a real issue for women who are taking chemotherapy. And part of the problem is that, in the past, doctors didn't even talk about it. They just gave you the chemo, and then afterwards, when you were infertile, they said, oops, well, you're lucky to be alive. And it wasn't an issue that was talked about ahead of time. What tends to happen is if you are close to menopause, if you're within 10 years of when you would have your natural menopause, then the chemotherapy will push you over. If you are further from menopause, let's say you're 30, 35, and really, then you often will get your period back again. And if you get your period back again, then you're still fertile.
I think that was one of the hardest parts of my whole my whole treatment. I couldn't believe that I wasn't going to get my period again. In March of the following year, I got my period again. And it was a year after I had started treatment. And I've gotten it regularly since then. And my doctors are amazed, but, you know, it's good to beat the odds in a positive way.
So that's just a little clip from what was about a 20-minute video that we actually used in the intervention. But I think, you know, I gave you a lot of background of what I found, but hearing the voices of women who have experienced this, they're all coping really well. They're actually, they come in to visit you and they actually look like they're doing pretty well. But there is a cost and there is a price, and you can see that it varies by age and perhaps demographics. So this was the design of the study, and we conducted this lost track of time, Barbara, late 1990s, early 2000s. And late 1990.
And 98.
So the women were picked up for this prospective observational and intervention study at the time they ended their treatment. So if they had just had a mastectomy, we enrolled them in the study at about 6 weeks. If they had a lumpectomy, it was a couple weeks after they finished their radiation. Mastectomy and chemotherapy out here, and lumpectomy and chemotherapy. And again, what happens with the lumpectomy and chemotherapy group is that they don't get the radiation until the end. So what this is, what I'm putting this up here to show you, is this is that upfront cost. This is how long that primary treatment is. Yeah, we used to do that radical mastectomy and it was all over and everybody said I got it all, but we didn't get it all. Now we do more limited surgery, but we have this really protracted period. And if a woman was getting Herceptin, she'd be getting that for a year. She'd be getting it concomitant with her chemotherapy and then out for a whole year. And then if she's going to be on endocrine therapy, we're talking about 10 years of therapy for a large number of women. So you can just see there's a kind of a long umbrella of therapy that's going on. So I'm going to show you data. Again, the randomized trial actually showed that the video was the most effective arm, and it's freely available now. We gave it back to the NCI. This recruitment was from offices of surgeons and medical oncologists across the three sites. We identified them shortly after diagnosis, and we actually did a registration telephone call where we actually administered the mental health scale of the SF-36 and the physical functioning scale, because we actually wanted to know if the women who ultimately participated in the trial, who we recruited way at the end of this treatment, were any different. It turned out that they were not. And then we had this geographic diversity. And again, this was 558 women, and you can see mean age about 56, 57, again, white, married, working. We had a little bit more diversity in the two coasts. And this is what these women look like right at the end of treatment. And you heard the women in the video talking about what they felt like. And what you see here is, again, really one of the first times I've actually seen a worse outcome with mastectomy. So I showed you my earlier studies where we didn't see much different between mastectomy and lumpectomy. But I think what's happening, and this is these two upper bars are the lumpectomy groups, is that women were having lesser axillary dissections. This is already at the time when the sentinel node biopsies were coming into vogue. And tumors were smaller, and some of them were being removed even at the initial surgery. So we have more physical impairment in the mastectomy group and more physical impairment in the chemo group. And so these are significantly different. More pain, as you can see here in the mastectomy group. And these are adjusted for age and other demographics. Again, to show you again, so we've taken a group of women who are basically feeling well, functioning at high levels, and we've made them sick or functionally having problems. And again, seeing here, again, about 0.8 of a standard deviation for the mastectomy groups. Other findings at the end of primary treatment after getting through all this: greater sexual problems and impact on sex life for those who had had chemo, so confirming a lot of the other things that we'd seen. Again, more than 50% of the women complained of either being unhappy with their appearance, hot flashes, aches and pains, forgetfulness, breast sensitivity, joint pains, muscle stiffness. Again, I'm using the same scales that I've used in normal populations so I can compare them. And again, if in the regression models that we did, they did in this cross section contribute to decrements in physical and mental health. So we then asked in this prospective comparative study, controlling for whether they were in the intervention, what intervention groups they were in, and other factors, did having chemotherapy make a difference in your subsequent recovery? So you already went through this. Did it have any long-lasting effect? And so if we just want to look at crude assessments without any kind of adjustments for propensity to get chemotherapy or not, which I'll talk about in a minute, here's that initial physical functioning scale a couple of weeks after surgery, and you can see the chemo and no chemo groups are similar, but we see physical functioning here better in the no chemo group early on, and we see that there's a decrement. This is the end of treatment, but coming to the same point over time. This is emotional well-being. That's that question about, well, did some groups feel better and accomplished, and what we see, and I'll show you some other subsequent data. Paradoxically, the women who got chemotherapy are actually functioning at a higher level, and I'll show you some data. Kind of counterintuitive, right? And then this is energy. We've been interested in recovery of energy, and what you see is, again, there's a substantial decrement, and there we think there are some biological predictors of persistent fatigue. So that was kind of the preliminary look at this. And then I said, you know, I really want to be able to tell women, if they've gone through all of this, what's their recovery trajectory going to be? So we decided to do a more detailed propensity score adjusted analysis of the women going forward. And this happens to be this paper up here. It was simultaneously published with a randomized controlled trial study that I had done with the NSABP, where we had three different kinds of chemotherapy. So we don't have a no treatment control arm, but I'm going to show you with some of the same scales a similar pattern. And then there was an editorial on both of these papers basically saying life after adjuvant chemotherapy for breast cancer, the news is mostly good. So these were our propensity score adjusted models. And the reason why we had to do this is the women who got chemotherapy in general were younger, okay? So that was something different. This was not a randomized trial. So the choice of giving chemotherapy to a patient was between the doctor and the patient and perhaps very specific things associated with the tumor. So we couldn't control for that. So with, again, the propensity-adjusted models, we looked at this and we took the perspective, if you got chemotherapy or you didn't, what would your recovery of your physical component score be over time? And again, in the year following this, there's a pretty similar trajectory whether you had chemotherapy or not. It's just that it's pushed out much longer in somebody who gets chemotherapy. If we look at this emotional recovery, again, not quite statistically significant, but you see paradoxically, the women who got chemotherapy seem to be having a better recovery emotionally. Again, these are the SF-36 scales and really not much going on here. I'm not going to spend time on this. But this is where I really want us to focus, and this is where the message is really for symptoms. And that's what's really lingering with most of these women. They have high levels of function, but symptoms are a problem. And this is vaginal problems, a much greater in the chemo group. This is musculoskeletal complaints. And this is weight problems, again, higher in the patients who got chemotherapy. So these are some of the persisting problems. And if we don't look at symptoms and these kinds of more focused problems and just look at quality of life, we miss these. This is from yes?
Just on that paradoxical finding on mental health, was that adjusted for treatment or depression?
We don't have treatment for depression per se. You know, we don't. We have medications. But most of the women,
is it possible that the women who got chemotherapy, they sort of got more treatment for depression? Or there were more of the high proportion of them were
We had CESD scores on both groups, and I don't recall that there was a difference. The younger women do have more depression, but we adjusted for these scores in the propensity models. But I think what I'm trying to say in some ways is that we've seen a lot of these things in multiple studies. So And that's, I think, one of the points that I'd like to make, is that when you see this in multiple studies over time, you become more confident. This was the randomized controlled trial, and it was a comparison in 5,000 women of three different treatment arms, and I'm not going to go into detail, except we used quality of life scales and symptom scales to look at the women. And again, while the trial shows that the six cycles of chemotherapy is better in terms of the compared to the four cycles, you can see these scores are pretty overlapping. And in this particular trial, we were actually able to look at whether women who got amenorrhea had fewer symptoms or not, greater symptoms. And what you see is that the arm that did not contain Cytoxan actually had a lower rate of amenorrhea. And again, that's a big issue for younger women who may want to still have treatment, children afterwards. But again, I want to show you the same pattern that during chemotherapy, there's a decrement in quality of life. This is the FACT trial outcome index. And you can see that the women actually come back to a higher level or better than where they were. But this is symptoms. This is our symptom checklist that we did. And again, about 10 mean symptoms and severity here. But again, persistent symptoms out to 18 months. So while overall women will tell you I'm functioning at a pretty high level, they still have a persistent burden of symptoms. And so again, the data from these two studies are consistent that while quality of life returns to pretreatment levels after adjuvant chemotherapy, the survivors have persistent symptoms, and this is really what has to be the focus of our survivorship care. So in summary, I think that you can use comparative effectiveness strategies by looking at different treatments, and in this case I've focused on quality of life outcomes as my endpoint, to look at outcomes that really have meaning and salience to patients. And often we have to do these because randomized controlled trial data are not available. When available, you saw that some of the RCT data did support the same observational outcomes. And again, the advantage that I've had is I've used many of the same instruments over time with consistent findings. So again, it's like doing multiple experiments in a laboratory. When you have findings that are consistently telling you the same thing, it does become, I think, believable. But in conclusion, for women with breast cancer, there's a considerable acute toxicity from the treatment, but women are quite resilient. Their overall quality of life comes back to normal about a year after treatment ends. But there are persistent problems that we have to take into consideration as we follow them, including premature menopause, some of the endocrine-associated symptoms, the sexual difficulties, musculoskeletal complaints, and fatigue and cognitive complaints. And again, a highly vulnerable group who's now I'm really focusing a lot of my work on are younger women for whom they may get this very effective therapy, but they're going to live another 30 or 40 years, and we don't know what the long-term consequences are, both physically and psychosocially for them. And that's where our survivorship care comes into place, where we really want to identify individuals who might be at risk for some of these effects of treatment and modify and tailor our therapy to avoid some of the late effects, to give safer therapies, and then if you are a survivor, to get palliative care that approaches these symptoms that may be persistent and troublesome. And just finally to thank many people who have been involved in my research over time as very important collaborators. So I'll take questions that you might have.
The goal of this work is to affect care. So I have two questions. One, I was privy on looking at some of Nina Bikel's work on the Abigail project she did on a couple other people in Mount Sinai. And my understanding is that if we put on the continuum of care, which you talked about today, you're over here somewhere. And the vast difference that the average woman doesn't even get told what's next after they leave surgery. That care for breast cancer patients, at least in New York City, both among the poor and the wealthy, is so discoordinated and so diffuse that what you're talking about is almost irrelevant to the practice of medicine at this moment. I mean, the second question, and I'm wondering how you comment on that, that we haven't even figured out how to politely tell a woman, you know, that she has cancer and what her choices are. And that's where the average surgeon and person that takes care of a woman with breast cancer is today in this country. And I don't know whether that's still true. The second question is, as you look at all of this work, how is quality of life yet at the point where you use it to change therapy with a patient, or are all the decisions still pretty much made on life expectancy? So you showed us a lot of consequences of chemotherapy and radiation therapy. You're probably the best practitioner here in this field. The proportion of women that would change what they get if you just did a quantity of life versus what you did here, are we at that point like the Lance Armstrong story about how to treat testicular cancer, where he modified what he was going to get, went to a specific place, and therefore, you know, illegally won 9 tours of France? I mean, the bottom line is, where are we?
Yeah, there? I think, you know, you pointed out a couple or more important things. Number one, there are huge disparities in the delivery of cancer care between, you know, what I might deliver in my office practice or my colleagues here might do in their practice compared to what might be done in a public hospital or a busy clinic. But we do, there has been a lot, so Nina's studies, which were done maybe a decade ago, have led to really intense programs of patient navigation out at All of You, which is one of our sister-affiliated hospitals. We actually have an Avon Breast Health Navigator program, which at least for that disease, we should have it for every disease, but for that disease has really made a difference in the management of those patients, not only in terms of getting their treatment in a timely way and getting follow-up, but we actually have a survivorship program, and the nurse who used to work with me here is actually delivering survivorship care that is pretty similar to what
we
do
here.
So
the basic problems, if you were going to do a random sample of women that got breast cancer in California or in Los Angeles at this moment, the fundamental basic problems of quality of care that I would almost call at a humane level, you believe have been solved in 99% of all women? Or 50%?
I mean, you know, Catherine has done work with her law study, and Steve Katz did a similar study. And there, you know, many women, at least in both of those studies, expressed, and correct me if I'm wrong, Catherine, but pretty good communication satisfaction, but we found persistent symptoms in that patient sample, and the symptoms are not being addressed. So these persistent things, I think what I was trying to say is that we do a pretty good job now with the treatment kind of continuum in terms of decision making and adjuvant therapy, and even there's something called Oncotype DX, I didn't show it to you, but if you have a node negative and now even a node positive breast tumor and it's hormone receptor positive, we can send it off and we can tell you that chemotherapy is going to be useless and that endocrine therapy is all you really need. So we can avoid chemotherapy. And there was a lot of concern that younger women in particular would want to go for everything. But I have had pretty good reception to younger women saying, I'm really happy I don't need to get chemo. And when I know what the consequences are of chemo from my quality of life research, I can say that it's a good decision. We have other decision-making tools called Adjuvant Online, which again, a lot of the randomized trial data is there. And so you can show the patient what the absolute and relative benefit is of the therapy. So I think in breast cancer, we're actually farther ahead. And in many settings where you've got people who only do breast cancer, this is probably more than norm. I think where the problem is you have the doc in the box who may be in a practice with one or two other physicians who sees everything that walks in the door. They're treating lung cancer, they're treating pancreas, they're treating breast cancer, and they don't have the time or the inclination.
So Danny Slayman's statement that 80% of perception of human people that have no benefit from it is wrong. I mean, he was publicly quoted on news. That 80% of their acceptance giving women are given to people that are negative on the receptor.
I don't think that's the case anymore. People like
you think this is now all different.
People like Lee Newcomer at United required. He did a little study of about 200 patients with breast cancer and asked the docs to fax in the HER2 new test, and maybe about 15 or 20% of them either didn't have the test done or were being inappropriately treated, but this is being monitored now, okay? And also the quality of the assays for both ER and CARE 2 are being, the American College of Pathologists has now actually come out because how you handle the tumor may be important. So, you know, again, I think there's a, as you saw those dissemination curves, those early dissemination curves I showed you for mammograms and for tamoxifen and for chemotherapy, it takes 15 or 20 years before all this happens. But the Herceptin trials, you know, were about 10 years ago. Yeah.
So, obviously, the earlier diagnosis has been a positive thing. But presumably, there's been some decline in the number of women dying of breast cancer.
Yes.
Right. And that can be quantified and is quantified. Mm-hmm. Although 5-year survival from diagnosis is a less useful measure when diagnosis is occurring earlier in the course of the disease. And presumably, a lot is known about the impact on survival of the various regimens. That's mm-hmm. what a lot of these studies have been mm-hmm. trying to do. But it would seem that the direction that your work takes is towards women, empowering them to be able to make time trade-offs. That is, how much chance of earlier death mm-hmm. and having to convey that in an appropriate way mm-hmm. Are you willing to take in exchange for not losing your periods or not having vaginal dryness or and a lot of other outcomes mm-hmm. Are the measures of both the
survival
stuff
and the qualities integrated
and the quality, are they precise enough to be able to allow people to seriously figure out where it is they fall?
They haven't been integrated in any models, but they obviously should. I mean, Peter Ravden, who's done the most with the adjuvant online, you know, at some point should be able to integrate some of these things because we do have data on these outcomes. But, you know, clearly the other things that we're interested in are cardiac toxicity. So I'm now seeing women who had Adriamycin who have no other risk factors who 15 years later are getting congestive heart failure. So we're, you know, looking carefully at that. I've done some studies looking at the late cardiac effects. We're looking in the trastuzumab Herceptin trial in the NSABP. We're now looking at cardiac function follow-up in MUGA scan, the quality of life, as well as drugs and symptoms. So we're looking at some of these things, and I think the issue for this particular disease is there's a long trajectory where women are going to age out into a time when they're going to have comorbid conditions that are going to be competing. And so how you kind of integrate all of these things together is really a challenge. So that's why I'm kind of focusing on the younger women, because that's a group where I see this very long horizon, and whatever we could do to modify that long horizon might make a difference. Yes?
Sort of related to that, but not really in the research sense. You don't have any preference measures, it looks like, that you reported.
No.
You see things like body image and stuff, and I kind of wonder, it seems like that would be important, but it's hard to get the bottom line impact here. Is there any applications that kind of puts it all together and says, overall, this is more beneficial and it costs this much, you know, sort of going towards this seminar series, if you wanted to make
There are some trials where we're looking at this. For instance, there's a partial breast irradiation trial that we have in the NSABP, so this is an RCT. But we're looking at body image, and we're looking at, these are all women who are going to have radiation, either whole breast, which lasts for 5 weeks or 6 weeks, versus the partial breast, which is 1 week. So we're looking at convenience of care, we're looking at disruptions, we're looking at these things in terms of collecting data, as well as the body image and these kinds of things to collect the data. But I think the big problem with this particular disease, even if you deal with older women, not just the younger women, is many women want to be treated aggressively. Okay, and particularly before we had these ways of personalizing the tumor and personalizing what we should give, if you told somebody there was a 1 or 2% difference if they took chemotherapy or not, they'd want to take it, you know. And so the challenge in terms of any preference is that women are looking at survival, they're not looking at the impact. We have a big problem right now with too many bilateral mastectomies that are being done unnecessarily. There's been a big uptick. And so the question is, why is this happening? Well, one of the things is that the immediate reconstruction is more available, flaps are available, we do skin-sparing mastectomies, and the cosmetic results, so the surgeon is kind of saying, well, it's not so bad. But if you look at my mastectomy reconstruction and lumpectomy data, the body image is worse, even if you don't have your own lens, okay? And even if it's reconstructed, okay? So these women are saying, I don't want to go through serial MRIs. I don't want to have to worry about this. Well, I was at University of Minnesota last week, and there was a political science professor, a young woman, who was not a gene carrier but had made the decision to have bilateral mastectomies. We were having dinner, and she said, you know, I made that decision, and I regret it now. And so I think we have a lot of these decisions that are being made that are possibly financial, but also driven by this fear of recurrence, let's just get it all off, I don't want to have to be worried about this part of my life. But there's no survival advantage to doing this. So, I mean, I hope that somebody will pull out my studies showing that, you know, it doesn't help. Yeah?
Yeah, you know, preference-based measures that would integrate across population, quality of life, and mortality. So not what individual necessarily prefers.
So you're talking about the Euroqol?
Yeah.
I have not used them. Yeah, we did use the Euroqol in one of our studies, but actually I think we did use the Euroqol in the sex study. I think we may have, but we have it, but we haven't analyzed it, okay? So, yes?
And why did this woman say that she regretted? I mean,
because a reconstructed breast is not your real breast. There's no sensation. They have a numb breast. There's no nipple, usually, you know, if you had an implant, they stand up and, you know, don't sag. You know, so it's not, and, you know, it's like you don't even, it's, yes, you look nice, you can wear clothes, you don't have to worry about a prosthesis. But these are the things that women in making these decisions don't appreciate. And again, Bob's right. If somebody came to me and talked to me about it, I'd tell them the, you know, the dirty details, okay? Right. And informed physicians, I don't know, Raquel, you, I don't know how your practice goes, but these are things that are the subtle, the symptoms. You know, yes, your quality of life is great, but these are the symptoms that you have persisting after. So even the choice of chemotherapy. And right now, because I'm working in the area of chemo brain, I have frequently patients calling me, I don't want to take chemo because I'm worried about chemo brain. Am I going to have this? And again, chemo can be life-saving and very essential, and we don't even know who will get that consequence.
Hey, Pat, for the sake of the comparative effectiveness movement, it would be great, given that you are the most really substantial work in this area, if you could write a two-pager that basically said, this is how my work has changed the way I practice, let alone how other people ought to practice. I mean, what do I do differently? And get away from the standpoint of the new drugs, because mm-hmm. everyone in Congress is all for new drugs. Mm-hmm. But all the other stuff, the adding on the quality of life stuff, the follow-up, all this other kind of work is under enormous pressure to be defunded. Mm-hmm. And it would be really great if you could say, as one that has a foot in both camps, I really changed the way I do, and I think many of my women make different choices because of how the work I've used, and here are the specific examples, or even specific patient scenarios, mm-hmm. because that's what's missing mm-hmm. from this field if we're going to continue, you know, putting pressure on to get it funded.
Where would I send it?
Oh, I don't worry about that issue at the moment. You can give it to this guy. He's going to be working with Andy Waxman starting in 3 weeks. That will help.
No, I'm
serious.
Yeah.
You ought to meet him.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Martin, did you?
I just lost my train of thought.
So you had a senior moment. Anyway, I just, you know, I think I've been very fortunate because I've been able to do this work. And, you know, I'm really grateful. And you know, as I was thinking about it, not everyone is so fortunate. I know a lot of you in health services have to jump from topic to topic, but I've been very lucky to be able to do this. Yes.
Well, so I do have a question because it actually relates to a patient I'm taking care of currently, who is a woman in her 60s who works in a health field and has breast cancer.
and had a fairly large primary, but no nodes, and is getting radiation therapy, and feels that she cannot reveal to her colleagues at a health institution that she has breast cancer because of the way in which they have treated someone else who works with her with breast cancer.
It's against the law.
Yeah, of course it is. But basically, when this other individual was going through their treatments and wasn't able to produce at the usual level, they required the individual to go on leave, when in fact this individual wanted to be able to work in a fairly serious way. And this person feels the same way.
She's like a shooter, Martin.
Well, but basically has become very depressed about being in this dilemma, feeling that it's basically stigmatized by an academic health center.
She needs to consult the Cancer Legal Resource Center at Loyola and speak to them about, you know, what she can do to help remedy her situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have dealt with very high-level professionals who don't want to tell people what's going on. But the problem is then people are gossiping about you. And, I mean, you don't have to tell everyone, but human resources or whoever, you need to speak to someone in confidence, because her performance may suffer as a result of her depression now, and who knows what they're going to be saying about her. So I always kind of say, you need to control what's being said about you.
I mean, is there much stigmatization still?
There is probably in a subtle way, but this is clearly illegal. Clearly illegal. And if there was a previous case of this and this is making her be this way, so I would definitely, the Cancer Legal Resource Center at Loyola is a terrific resource that I'd send her to.
Thanks.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.